Okay, we're running a little late, so I think we're just going to get started. We're one panelist short, but hopefully he'll show up in time to begin. My name is Reed Kotless. I'm with the Platypus Affiliated Society, and this is the Politics of Work panel. Thank you all for coming. I'm just going to briefly introduce Platypus, the organization that organized this panel, and then I'm going to introduce the panelists and the topic, and then we're going to have them read opening statements, respond briefly to each other, and we're going to take questions from the audience. Platypus is a project for the self-criticism, self-education, and ultimately the practical reconstitution of a Marxian left. We do this by organizing reading groups, public fora, teach-ins, and other public events, as well as through our monthly newspaper and forum in print, the Platypus Review. There are copies of a couple different issues of the Platypus Review available on the table on the side wall, as well as some other information about Platypus. We have chapters throughout the U.S., including Boston, Chicago, New York, and Philadelphia, in Canada, including in Montreal, Toronto, and Halifax, and internationally, including the U.K., Germany, Greece, and Austria. You can find out more about Platypus, including the complete digital archives of the Platypus Review, at our website, platypus1917.org. So on the panel today, we have Robert Pollan, who is the co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute here at UMass, as well as professor of economics. His books include Back to Full Employment in 2012, A Measure of Fairness, The Economics of Living Wages and Minimum Wages in the United States in 2008, and The Living Wage, Building a Fair Economy in 1998. Stanley Aronowitz has taught at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York since 1983, where he is a distinguished professor of sociology and urban education. He is author or editor of 25 books, including Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future, The Last Good Job in America, and The Jobless Future. Jason Wright is a member of the International Bolshevik Tendency, which was formed by a group that split from the Spartacist League in 1982. He contributes to the IBT's journal, 1917. I'm going to briefly read a set of questions that we gave to the panelists. It's a long and complicated set of questions. We certainly don't expect all of them to be answered, necessarily even addressed, but we did want to give a kind of common framework from which to work. So I'm going to read through those, and then we're going to begin with the presentations, starting with Professor Pollan. Question one, how do you characterize work and employment as a political issue in contemporary society? What is wrong with unemployment, and or what is wrong with work? Two, a distinction is drawn between work as purposeful human activity, presumably existing before and after capitalism, on the one hand, and work in the sense of labor in capitalism, where the worker undertakes purposeful activity for money under threat of material scarcity, typically in the form of wage labor. Is this distinction politically relevant when thinking about work? In a free society, would work manifest in one or both of these senses? If the widely observable phenomenon of overwork and unemployment is a necessary feature of capitalist society, why and how is this so? What kinds of social necessity in the present organization of the world do you take to be the underlying this phenomenon? Then give your understanding of the nature of this necessity. What would it mean to radically transform it? Four, in the history of the left, what examples do you regard as informing your attitude towards the politics of work and unemployment today? And what is relevant about these touch points? Five, historically, the left has sought to remedy the problems of overwork and unemployment through various means. Full employment, a guaranteed minimum income regardless of employment, and/or shorter working hours for those employed. Which of these, if any, do you consider to be adequate responses, and how, if at all, should the left pursue them? Should the abolition of wage labor be a goal for emancipatory politics? What political strategies and tactics should be pursued to attain this goal? How do we get from here to there? Seven, given the breadth of issues and struggles pursued by the left historically and today, race and racism, gender equality, environmental concerns, globalization, militarism, etc., what is the relationship between the politics of work and the broader project of social emancipation? Exactly how central or peripheral is the politics of work to social emancipation as such? Where do you find the most promising attempts by the left to address the issue of work and unemployment today? What makes this contemporary work relevant and propitious? 9, what role, if any, do you assign to political organizations, such as an actual or potential political party, in working to progressively transform contemporary relations of work and unemployment? What should be the relationship between any such organization and the working class? And 10, a century ago, these questions were consciously taken up by a politically constituted workers' movement in which socialists and Marxists participated. Today, discussions of this topic risk becoming utopian in the apolitical sense. How, if at all, has the decline of the workers' movement and the death of the left circumscribed our ability to engage the politics of work in the present? So we're going to give each panelist 8 to 10 minutes to read some opening remarks. Hopefully they will be able to address as much of that head-spinning questionnaire as possible. And then we are going to give each panelist 3 to 4 minutes to respond to each other. After that point, we're going to open the floor to questions. And I'd just like to remind the panelists, we're all very grateful to hear you speak today, but we have a limited amount of time, and we would like to get as much in from everyone as possible. So if you could please regulate your time, and I will also be regulating you with these wonderful little signs. Okay, Dr. Pollan, if you'd like to begin, and then we'll have Dr. Iwanowitz and Mr. Wright. Thank you.
Wow, so this is really tight.
my time's already up. I try to discipline myself. Okay, so first of all, I want to thank Reed for inviting me, and I want to, I'm glad you read off your questions. There's no way I'm going to get through all of them, but they're very interesting. And in addition to the questions, the quotes that Reed and his colleagues collected are really quite evocative, all three of them, from Frederick Jameson, Joan Robinson, and Andre Gorz. And so I'm going to play off of them a little bit, and I will start with question 4, which is, in the history of the left, what examples do you regard as informing your attitude towards the politics of work and unemployment today, and what is relevant about these touch points? So since we are a Marxist conference, naturally I'm going to start with Karl Marx. So, and I love the quote from Jameson, which I'd never seen before. Capital is not a book about politics and not even a book about labor. It's a book about unemployment. I think there is a lot of truth in that, in a profound way, in that not only is chapter 25 of volume 1 about the Reserve Army of Labor, and in my view, as far as I know, the first serious analysis of unemployment as a phenomenon and the necessity for a massive unemployment to exist in order for capitalism to function. And I'm not going to get into this in depth, but I will just mention it. In my own view, the arguments that Marx makes there in chapter 25 are not the only place in which he's talking about unemployment. That's why I love the Jameson quote, which is, in my view, that chapter links up with the entire theory of the labor theory of value, the extraction of surplus from labor, because in the absence, in a full employment economy, in the absence of mass unemployment, the working class has more political power, which, of course, is what Marx explains. And when the working class has more political power and has the capacity to bargain up their wages, that means that the rate of surplus value declines. You could think of that as offering a fundamental challenge to the prerogatives of capital and to the ability to extract surplus from workers. So Marx was the first great theorist of unemployment. Whether the whole book is about unemployment, that's a debate, as Jameson says, but it certainly is a deep point, maybe the deepest insight in the whole of capital. And so if we go from the great theorists of unemployment, we go from Marx certainly to Keynes. And Keynes's view on unemployment was, very, very briefly, that this is a solvable problem within capitalism, and all we need to understand the technical means to control aggregate demand and instability in the investment process due to the power of Wall Street and speculation. Once we can control those, we can tame the worst excesses of capital. We can increase public investment, and as such, we can organize capitalism around the idea of full employment. So that's obviously a direct challenge to Marx's notion that unemployment is fundamental to the operations of capitalism. Okay, so from there we go, in my view, to the best 6 pages ever written in political economy. And that is the essay by the Polish socialist Michael Kolecki called The Political Aspects of Full Employment. Kolecki's argument I take to be a very creative synthesis of Marx and Keynes, in that Kolecki is arguing that, yeah, Keynes is right, we can do all those things. Yeah, we can get to full employment. Keynes is brilliant, he figured it out, the problem is aggregate demand, that's what made capitalism collapse. But then he says, yeah, but you know what, Marx is also right, and capitalism needs mass unemployment, but if we don't have mass unemployment, then workers get too much power. And if workers get too much power, Kolecki doesn't focus on the argument about the extraction of surplus values so much as he does on the issue of capitalists losing their prerogatives, that capitalists will lose control over capitalism, workers will get too self-confident, bad. Kolecki's saying, he doesn't think it's bad for capital. And Kolecki's saying, well, there is a solution to this within capitalism, and it's before our eyes. Remember that Kolecki's paper comes out in 1944, and it's fascism. He says, well, fascism solves that problem because you can have full employment and you can also control workers getting too much power. Okay, so that's kind of where we leave it in terms of the great analysts. And then this gets translated now to question number 4 into, you know, how do you deal with these things politically? And in my view, in the history of the left, what examples as you regard as informing your attitude, I think the most creative way of addressing this over the last 50 or 60 years is the Nordic model of social democracy based on the work of Rudolf Meidner and Gösta Rehn, or as my old professor Robert Heilbrunner called it, not Sweden, but slightly imaginary Sweden. Not exactly what Sweden was, but the idea of full employment macroeconomic policy, but led by the working class. That is, you have to have strong unions, as they did in Sweden, and the unions were the ones that were establishing the terms of full employment. And what could possibly make full employment under this version of capitalism sustainable was that, yes, the unions would accept some degree of wage restraint in exchange for having control over macroeconomic policy. So another way of saying it is that unions would take responsibility for this inflation-unemployment trade-off in exchange, again, for maintaining full employment. So the unions would set the terms of the debate. Now, of course, that depends on having strong unions. This kind of framework was very much on my mind when I had this project in sub-Saharan Africa with the United Nations on decent employment creation and poverty reduction, focusing in South Africa and Kenya and Ghana. And even though obviously Kenya's not really that much like Sweden or the United States, the basic concepts of empowering the working class to take control of macroeconomic policy, which to my mind is an answer to the challenge thrown down by Kolecki, is, I think, a very, very kind of energizing, empowering concept. Now, by contrast, I want to raise something which I think is much more problematic than many of us on the left think, including maybe many of us in this conference, which is the idea of workplace democracy and co-ops. I'm not against workplace democracy and co-ops, of course, but I don't think many of us on the left have thought through that there are challenges and difficulties involved with those as well. And maybe the most fundamental critique was offered by my UMass colleague, Nancy Fulbray, who referred to the problem of the dictatorship of the sociable. That is, in principle, it's great to have workplace democracy, except, you know, who's going to really be running the democratic show is the people that are going to show up at all the meetings. Another way that she put it was that it was a vision of life as one long student council meeting. So I think we need to take these things seriously. And what really drilled that home to me was actually my work in South Africa when I was presenting a case for a full employment, you know, post-apartheid South Africa, which included a strong support for worker co-ops, workplace democracy. And some people who were activists, who were members, had been members of co-ops, and one guy got up and he said, "You've got to be kidding me. How can you just raise this, you know, unproblematically?" He says, "Do you realize what a disaster it was, you know, and how it's much the workplace democracy co-op movement set us back here?" For the reasons essentially that Nancy raised. So I think we need to be, in terms of, you know, what examples do you regard as informing, I think we need to take that more seriously. My last point, on number 8 in the list, what are the most promising attempts today? Here is something from the Associated Press this morning. In largest protests yet, fast food workers seeking higher wages walk off jobs across U.S. So we have a very powerful, positive movement going on right now, which is fast food workers going on strike, demanding a $15 an hour raise. I can go into details on that later. Thanks.
Stanley?
I'm going to address number 6, and I guess number 9. The demand for full employment and for jobs always presupposes the constancy of the prevailing system of economic and political power. Under our system, if you're out of work, Joan Robinson is totally right. We have unemployment benefits that are usually constrained by time limits. We have no real guaranteed income program. The last one we had was in 1969 when Daniel Patrick Moynihan, President Nixon's domestic policy advisor, proposed $1,600 a year. And the movement of poor people at that time rejected it as not being enough. $1,600 a year per person. This is not $1,600 a year per household. That was the last time we even heard the conversation, except a small group called BIG, Basic Income Guarantee Group, and I'm part of that, although I'm not, I go to the meeting sometimes, but I'm not in the active part of it. But that's not the same as being for full employment as a real perspective over the long run. The abolition of wage labor was Marx's basic demand. He had two things that he thought, in immediate sense, had to be addressed. Otherwise, you could not have a revolutionary communist movement. I'm not a socialist, by the way. I have to say that because it's important. I'm not a social democrat. I think social democracy is over. I think there are some reforms that are possible, but not a social democratic Sweden. They had a general strike in 1931. That's why you had a strong labor. That's why you had all the welfare state. If we had a general strike in the United States, as opposed to Greece, you might have a real situation where you have to consider, what do we do next? But the problem at this point is that under capitalism, wage labor sucks. And anybody who's ever done real wage labor, and I didn't do much. I spent 10 years in a steel mill. 10 years. I made more money than most people make in 10 years who are in the working class. I had two kids, a wife, and I didn't make enough to live on. But I made more than most people did. But the work itself, the conditions of the work itself, where I was dependent on an economic situation over which I had no control, either both of which controlled by the employer and controlled by the market forces, I could get laid off, and I was laid off, and I was laid off, and I was laid off in that 10 years, 9 years, 9.5 years. I then, at one point, I have to say this because it's important. When I got laid off, I got a job in the GM assembly plant. And the GM assembly plant paid me 25% more than the steel plant that I worked in. The job was dreadful. I fled back to the steel plant when they called me back. I thought I had gone to hell working in an assembly plant of the General Motors, Buick's Pontiac plant in Linden, New Jersey. Why? Because we were producing 60 cars an hour. It was hot as hell, especially in the summer. When I went to the steel plant, how did people act? When it got to be 85 degrees, we banked the furnaces and we walked out. Why? Because it was intolerable. Because the job itself was intolerable, but when we had the opportunity, we had a strong union. You really want a strong union. We walked out, banked the furnaces so that we didn't ruin the furnaces. But the job, as a concept, was really a form of terrible subordination. And the only reason people want jobs is because otherwise they starve. So when you talk about the abolition of wage labor, it becomes, in some sense, you want to use the word, a utopian demand that begins to define what the struggle is about. Not necessarily that we're going to abolish wage labor tomorrow, but we understand that the abolition of capitalism should entail the abolition of wage labor. The second demand, which should inform social and class struggle, is the demand for shorter hours, because we know that all work is shit under capitalism. Yeah, don't worry about it. I'm going to be even less than that. All work is shit. I'm a professor. I have a relatively good teaching load. I have a lot of students, though. That's a problem. No, but you know what I mean. It's, you have maybe not many courses, but you have students. But let's face it. I know this you may think is an annoyance, but as a professor, I have to turn in, I don't believe in grades, but I have to turn in grades. I have to give people A's and B's and whatever else I get. As a professor, I have responsibilities in terms of administering an institution that I think is absolutely corrupt, which is the City University of New York. It's a small institution, only has about 400,000 students, 16,000 members of the faculty. But everybody is in their seats because they want jobs. The opportunity to get learning done is very minimum, and so on. What I'm saying is that even those of us who get paid well and have a relatively sane teaching load are responsible to a bureaucratic system which itself constrains our own creativity. Wage labor is the death of creativity. So you want to fight it as much as you can, and one way of fighting it is to fight it through shorter hours. Now, you want shorter hours for other reasons. One of the other reasons you want shorter hours is because you can spread the lousy work that exists under the present circumstances. You see what I'm saying? But if you don't fight for shorter hours, and we haven't had that fight since 1938, then what you're inviting is overwork. You're inviting more and more contingency. What I'd like to do is to say, okay, if Walmart says they will only pay for 28, they'll only employ you for 28 hours instead of 30 hours, because then they don't have to pay health benefits. They don't have to pay health benefits or, you know, contribute to health benefits. Then what you should say is that the 28 hours should be full-time pay. That would be a useful fight in Walmart. And it's like the fast food workers, $15 an hour begins to discourage things. But what happens when you have a strong labor movement? And I'm going to stop here in a minute. The strong labor movement that we had in the late 30s through the part of the 40s, and in the 60s it got a little stronger again, the strong labor movement stimulates technological change. The stimulation of technological change reduces jobs. What technology is about is not Nintendo. Technology is about the elimination of living labor. The old man taught us that, and it's in the Grundrisse between 690 and 720. If you haven't read the Grundrisse between 690 and 720, you don't understand much about technology. But the point is, what happens then is that the organization of labor by capital and by the state is to make it increasingly unstable and increasingly contingent, so that their good jobs have disappeared. Finally, if good jobs have disappeared, if there is no future employment possibility, we have two choices. One choice is to create jobs through the state. I'll be happy to have that if you want to do that. I don't think you're going to get very far, but that's good. That's important. Not infrastructure stuff. Nobody works in the roads anymore. Go down the road and watch the number of workers in road repair or whatever. Nobody. It's all done by machine, right? Same thing. So if you have that kind of a situation, the reserve army is going to swell, and so the third major demand has to be guaranteed income, has to be paying people because there aren't enough jobs. Full employment, maybe. But working towards the abolition of wage labor, that's the key. One way of doing it is shorter hours. The second is guaranteed income. And so that's something that is still on the horizon, because both the left and the labor movement have, by and large, given it up.
Okay. So I think it, you know, should go without saying at a conference of this nature that the question of class politics and the question of the role of the working class is not a fetishization of the working class, but a recognition that the working class is the only class that is in a position to bring about true human liberation. And that is based on the relationship that the working class has to the means of production. For Marxism, of course, human history is a history of class struggle. And capitalism, as the form of class society that we've arrived at today, has the central opposition between the bourgeoisie, which owns the means of production, and the working class, which actually creates all the profit under capitalism that the capitalists reap. And, you know, I know that that's sort of a strange perspective sometimes for people in the U.S. today, where the myth has existed for so long that everyone is middle class. Everyone from a file clerk to a doctor to a manager is considered all a part of the middle class in the way that things are presented on the news and on television. And I think one thing that Occupy Wall Street brought back into public consciousness was the idea that there's a very small percentage of the population that actually has a tremendous amount of control in the society based on their ownership of the means of production. And I think one of the reasons why a populist movement like that could come to that conclusion or see that today is because that we have corruption and bribery and sort of the naked contempt for the vast majority of the population that is on a display in a way that it hasn't been since the Gilded Age. Like, so to talk about, you know, 100 years ago, the Marxist movement posed these questions in a certain way. The questions are all still the same, really. What's happened is that for a long time there were various ways in which that question was sublimated in the mainstream discourse within the U.S. And, you know, I think that there's a reason for that. You know, relatively to many other countries, in the United States, there has been a relative lack of class consciousness, a lack of the working class seeing its historic role and seeing its relationship to the means of production. And, you know, a lot of writers have offered various explanations for that. I think that, you know, some of the primary ones that we can touch on are the legacy of slavery and of racism in this country and the ability for employers to exploit divisions between black workers and white workers. The super exploitation of immigrants as they came to this country, and again, the use of xenophobia to divide workers from each other on the assembly line. And then again, you know, you did have the fact that the assembly line and these terrible conditions of oppression on the shop floor actually have also played the factor of bringing workers together who would not have talked to each other before through the trade unions, you know, and of, you know, so it's something that has cut both ways, certainly. And then, you know, there has been a safety valve early in the U.S. history with westward expansion and a relative class mobility, perhaps, in comparison to Europe. So industrial unionism in this country arrives relatively late, but it makes significant inroads when it arrives, and arrives in a really explosive fashion during the Great Depression. Not at the beginning of the Depression, but, you know, around 1934, you know, the working, the labor movement has sort of been knocked to its knees by the Depression, and then as conditions get so bad that some sort of resistance is necessary, you have, you know, three significant strikes in 1934, and I think it's worth noting that all of them were led ostensibly by revolutionaries. You had a waterfront strike in San Francisco that was led by the Stalinized Communist Party. The Toledo Auto Light Strike that was led by the Musteites, who would then merge into the Trotskyist movement in this country, and the Minneapolis Teamster Strike, which was led by the Trotskyists. And these three strikes really paved the way for the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. And the relatively short period of time in which there was a mass labor revolt ends up by being tamed, essentially by the politics of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration in the early years of World War II, ultimately with a certain complicity by both the Stalinists and the Social Democrats, who were willing to subordinate the independence of working class struggle in the U.S. to the imperialist war drive for World War II, through things like the No-Strike Pledge and compulsory union arbitration, which the bureaucracy of the labor movement was willing to accept in exchange for dues checkoff and union recognition. There was opposition to this. John Lewis, of course, famously opposed the No-Strike Pledge. The Minneapolis Teamsters actually were quite vocal in their opposition to it. And in July of 1941, FDR arrested 29 prominent Trotskyist leaders, many associated with the Teamsters Union in Minneapolis, for their opposition to the No-Strike Pledge under the Smith Act laws. You had relative quiescence until the end of World War II, when there was a massive strike wave from 1945 to 1946, with almost 9 million workers striking. Truman responded with sweeping strike-breaking legislation, including Taft-Hartley, and the legacy of Taft-Hartley is something that we're all living with today. Also in the immediate period after World War II came the Red Purge of the early McCarthy period, with the removal of many seasoned militants from the union movement. The only politics permitted at that point in the 1950s were essentially those of the bureaucracy. And I think that really poses sort of what is the task in the labor movement today, and there's not much time to really talk about a lot of stuff, but I think that the most essential need is the fight to bring political consciousness back into the labor movement, as opposed to the contest between various factions within the bureaucracy of the labor movement and a sort of lesser evilism that prevails even within the trade union movement. That what needs to happen is the construction of programmatically based caucuses within the trade union movements that are able to pose political issues beyond the simple bread and butter issues within trade unions today, and take the fight beyond mere defensive posture to something that actually speaks to the need for the emancipation of the working class. One of the things that our organization uses as a model for that, within our very modest limitations, is the Transitional Program, which was the founding document of the Trotskyist Fourth International in 1940. The Transitional Program was conceived of by Trotsky as a way of bringing forward very immediate demands that could be raised within the unions and within the movements of social struggle that would at the same time pose the fundamental question of capitalism and be a bridge to a revolutionary consciousness for workers. One of the examples that I've really looked to is the work that was done in the International Longshore Workers Union in the 1970s and 1980s by the then revolutionary Spartacist League. The program that that the militant longshoremen had was one of 6 hours of shift at 8 hours pay, with no pay cut, which reflected the transitional program's 30 for 40. The defense of the hiring hall, that is, that the union would control the assignments and where workers would work on unloading ships. The defending of the union conditions and safety through job actions without reliance on the government. Defense of the union. Building labor solidarity, opposing employer and government strike breaking, including defying injunctions. They raised anti-fascist demands, which were meant to also be a bridge to the largely black and Latino workforce in the union and to focus on the immediate demands and recognize the oppression that workers faced under capitalism. The call for working class action in international. And the break with the Democratic and Republican parties. And the legacy of that, actually, even though the caucuses have not existed as such, you know, for almost 20 years now, is that there have been many militants that went through that experience, had the experience of participating in 1984 hot car going actions against South African goods being brought into the U.S. And there was a West Coast one-day longshore strike against the war in Iraq. There was also a one-day job action that shut down ports up and down the West Coast, demanding freedom for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And finally, just to wrap up, the other speakers already touched on it, but I think that, you know, one thing that we see, since in some ways we're in an analogous period with this recession as where the strikers were in 1934 in the Great Depression, is that working conditions have been pushed back so much. People are working so many more hours for so much less money. Unemployment has lingered for so long that you're beginning to get fight back just from the fact that people cannot survive this way much longer, and you're getting it at the very bottom of the workforce with things like the fast food workers' strike. So, you know, I think that if we had a union movement that was not completely bureaucratized and corrupted at this point, it would be putting a lot more energy into reaching out and organizing low-wage workers, and that that is a role that conscious Marxists should play within the trade union movement.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd now like to invite each panelist to briefly respond in about 3 or 4 minutes to each other's comments. We'll proceed in the same order that we had the initial presentations in.
Well, I really appreciate all the comments, and I don't know what my label is. So I said I liked slightly imaginary Sweden, so that I guess made it sound like I was social democratic, but I don't think the. I was saying Stanley said that he wasn't a socialist or a social democrat, and I don't really know what my own label is. But here, let's get to more specific things. I really take a lot of inspiration from your last point on seeing that the fast food workers are striking. They're raising the issue of living wages for themselves. Obviously, it's not the same thing as fighting for shorter hours and a guaranteed income, but effectively it is addressing the issue of shorter hours, because if you can make $15 an hour instead of $7.25 an hour, you don't have to work 70 hours.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, some of my research on this, you know, I've done work on the living wage. We interviewed workers that got living wage increases, actually, in Boston. And we said, well, what happened to your life? And they, well, yes, I didn't have to work 3 jobs. I only had to work 1.5 jobs. And, you know, and I could get my car repaired, and I could, you know, maybe buy a new refrigerator for my mother. I mean, these were the specific kinds of things. So these things are really important. In terms of the labor movement, I do think that there are some really positive things happening in the labor movement. I mentioned in the last panel, the nurses union is, I think, the most creative, militant, exciting union in the country. And they're, part of it is that they are raising issues specific to nurses, but then they broaden out their agenda. And their agenda includes Medicare for all, so a single payer. If you had single payer health insurance, also, well, you know, people wouldn't have to have a job to have health insurance. They would have a job because they live here. I mean, they would have health insurance because they live here. So it is getting to your concern. Secondly, they have been in the leadership on the so-called Robin Hood tax, which is to tax Wall Street. It is not a revolutionary demand, but it is a very powerful challenge to the prerogatives of Wall Street. And for me, the fact that it's coming from nurses, I've done some work with this on them, and the Boston Herald had their editorial saying, this is absurd. Nurses? Since when are nurses supposed to tell us how to run the financial market? Well, the whole point is exactly, yeah, nurses should be telling the Wall Street barons how to run the financial market and other people like that. So I think this is a, you know, very positive, challenging development. Another area that I think is very positive, though limited at this point, is the merging of the labor activists with the environmental movement, as opposed to seeing the labor movement as opposed to the environment, because of this notion that there's this necessary fundamental trade-off between protecting the environment and creating jobs. So these kinds of things are bubbling up, and I see these as positive creative developments within the labor movement. And finally, with my nine seconds remaining, I think these things capture the spirit of Occupy. I see them as more positive developments than Occupy, if you had to do these comparisons, precisely because they're tied to specific demands. And the thing that made, in my view, Occupy dissipate was that in the end, there were no demands.
Thank you. Stanley?
Yeah. I'm going to devote the 4 minutes that I have at my disposal.
I thought it was three. I only got three. Yeah.
Well, got
he
four.
Gets four?
Oh.
Got
three to four. Did you say how much? Seven?
as long as 4 minutes is to you, Stan.
All right. I'm going to devote it to trying to explain what Fred Jameson is talking about when he says capital is about unemployment. I haven't talked to Fred about it. He and I established a journal called Social Text many years ago. We're still very good friends, and I think I know his thinking. By the way, Bob, it's in his book on capital, volume
one.
Yeah,
I know you said
yeah,
that.
I just wanted to let you know. But let me explain pull it back to something I was talking about before. The capital, one of the most important sections of capital is where he talks about the production of relative surplus value. Relative surplus value is the process of capitalist production when the machines increase the productivity of labor even as the profit rate on a per unit basis declines, and also machines increase the volume of production at the same time. Now, if you think about capitalist production over a very long period of time, and Marx really thought this way, what you find is that even with ostensible economic growth, the part played by labor in the production of material goods declines. The labor that used to be very, very, and I'll just give you one example. Automobile workers used to put in parts by hand when I worked there. And now I've looked at automobile plants, and what happens now is robots actually combine the tasks so that the same worker produces seven or eight different tasks that used to be produced by others. There used to be 600,000 workers in the steel industry, and now there are about 100,000 workers in the steel industry, 15%. 15% in textile, and so on and so on. So that the way in which capitalism has solved the problem of what would be mass unemployment is by transferring employment to what is called the services, which really are super exploited, pay very low wages. We all know that story. That's why the fast food workers are out there. That's why the Walmart workers are out there. But the point is that if they begin to organize, and they are beginning to organize, I think you're entirely right, they're going to put more automation into the process of retailing. And that means they're going to eliminate labor. That's the way that's one of the ways in which capital recoups its losses as a result of higher wages and the building of union strength. So we're always in the fight between union aggressive fight for their own wages better and better conditions and capital's reaction. That's what the class struggle is. And capital's reaction is always to eliminate labor. Therefore, what labor has to do, what workers have to do, is begin to ask the question, should we be working anyway so long? Should we be working, at all if we get to be of a certain age? So we should actually have a 55-year instead of a 67 or 70-year retirement age. That would be a form of unemployment, which would be well-paid because we'd have guaranteed income. So what I'm saying is that what Fred is referring to, what Jameson is referring to is that he's actually talking about, in Capital, Volume 1 and Volume 3 and the Grundrisse, he's talking about the conditions where labor becomes increasingly significant but at the same time becomes increasingly redundant. And that is a contradictory aspect of the history of capitalism.
Okay, so at a conference called Rethinking Marxism, I'm going to start with the premise that we all agree that unemployment is endemic to capitalism and is a part of how capitalism operates, both having a reserve labor force that it can shift around and also the role that unemployment can have in suppressing wages. During the Minneapolis Teamster strike that I referred to in 1934, one of the important things that the militants did was to organize support for unemployed workers and to raise demands for unemployment relief, and also to try to get unemployed workers to be a part of supporting the picket lines that the Teamsters were organizing. You know, the reason they did this was not only because the strike was largely led by Trotskyist militants who had a Marxist consciousness, but also was for the very pragmatic reason that they knew that the bosses would also try to utilize unemployed workers as strike breakers. That, you know, with massive unemployment during the Great Depression, the unemployed could be lured into, you know, betraying the strike movement. And by being advocates of and tribunes sort of for the unemployed, they showed that the Minneapolis Teamsters were on the same side as the unemployed. And if anyone's got any experience in practical trade union organizing today, the distance between that philosophy and the philosophy under which many of the union bureaucracies operate on a day-to-day basis is substantial. I mean, I've been a part of several unions in the last 20 years, and to the degree that there's a concern with unemployment issues, it's a general welfare concern that's, you know, a part of a general liberal ideology, but not, you know, from the perspective of the reorganization of society on a fundamentally different basis. And I think that that fundamentally comes from a consciousness that arises from something beyond that of simply economic struggle. And I think that is the true insight that Lenin had in seeing the need for a vanguard party, in seeing the need for a revolutionary organization that could bring consciousness to the working class from outside the class and be a leader in class struggle. I think that it really takes a political intervention into the trade union movement at this point to renew it, to fight for leadership, to pose questions on a truly revolutionary political perspective, and show workers that it is within their own interests to call for the abolition of capitalism, that it's not a matter of getting a better deal, of getting a few more crumbs from the table, but of transforming society. That that those who work the means of production should be those that own the means of production, to that degree, like it won't be a surprise to anyone, but I don't think that the Northern European countries are really a model or a solution for the way forward. I think what you get is a form of capitalism in which the rough edges have been sanded off, in which the fundamental exploitation and the fundamental alienation that was posed in the question remains. Where the labor is still for a wage, where it's still an exploitation that somebody else is profiting off of, it's simply that the welfare state is robust enough that, you know, it can support the workers at above a minimal level. But the reality is that you hit an economic crisis and that will all be taken away again. And really, that's the lesson of the decline from the prosperity of the American century, when the U.S. was wealthy off of the Reconstruction following World War II and, you know, a massive expansion of industry. We see what the state of the U.S. is today. You know, I mean, the profits will be maintained by the capitalists, and it will just be by extracting, you know, and exploiting more.
Okay, I'd like to open the floor for questions, and I'll take two questions at a time. So if you'd just like to raise your hands and begin giving questions. Yes, go ahead.
This opening up or zooming into the idea of what the labor movement is, right? In the sense of the subjectivity that Dr. Aronovitz always refers to. And one of the first rethinkers of Marx, that was Gramsci, right? cover this economic package, right?
Anyone else? Go ahead.
My question is just for Professor Paulin, would you mind expanding a little more on the sort of labor and environmental coalition that you mentioned? Because I thought that was really interesting.
Should I just
go ahead?
What about that? Okay. Well, the background is of course the idea that there's this massive trade-off, and this is the this is the impetus behind the struggle around the Keystone Pipeline, for example, and fracking, which is that you can be for the environment, that's cool, but it's mainly for people who are very privileged already, because it's going to hurt jobs. And so you just say, okay, what's the trade-off? In fact, there are polls. New York Times very recently had a poll. Which one is more important to you, jobs or the environment? Actually, a lot of my own research in the last few years has been to show that that trade-off does not exist. And the simple reason is that building a green economy, a no-carbon economy, is a massive industrial policy project, and it will create jobs, a lot of jobs. It's ironic that when we talk about military spending and we say, you can't cut military spending because you lose jobs. Well, actually, if you build a green economy per $1 million of expenditure, you create twice as many jobs as you do in the military. That's some of my research. So there are coalitions formed around this. One is called the Blue-Green Alliance, which is a massive, I mean, on paper at least, it's this massive organization. I don't know how many unions, 7, 8 unions, and I don't know, 5 or 6 environmental groups. And then the other one, and I don't get the exact name right, which is kind of Labor Greens Coalition for Sustainability that I know of. And that one is a more... I was at their founding meeting in June. It was saying that, well, the Blue-Green Alliance is cool, but it is these big, big organizations, so it's very bureaucratized, and everything has to pass through all these different votes, and nobody's going to always agree. But this is more individuals, people who are in the individuals who are in the labor movement or in environmental movement, but not representing their organizations, which on the one hand means it doesn't have all this immediate clout, but on the other hand has the presence to really explore things in a deeper way and without having this bureaucratic baggage that you're referring to. So I think those things are very positive developments. I will say that in a very significant, though limited in time way, is the stimulus program, the Obama 2009 stimulus program, with all of its flaws, included by far, by orders of magnitude, $90 billion for green investments on the idea that it would create jobs. So it was, in all of U.S. history, it was the most powerful endorsement of the idea of building a green economy is good for workers. Now, I and others can criticize a lot of aspects of it, but that idea, and to put that much resources behind it, was a major breakthrough.
I need the other panelists like to respond. I have another question. Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean it's a reflection on the idea of your kind of meditation, or where you mentioned before, can also be the final of the vision of, instead of the union, the subject instead of the union, which is sort of a, kind of an ugly mountain that comes from the consciousness that we are talking about, that it's a necessary step for some of the agency, right? So I don't think I've heard it. So I hear union and it means a lot of things, talking to questions, as a set of ideas, but how do we play with this change of imagination that is necessary also to dismantle what union means in
people. I would like to, can I respond?
Okay.
Or you want to go to another question?
Well, she was asking the first round of questions.
Oh, so you want to ask Bob?
You respond to
no, I, all of you.
Look, during the Civil Rights era, 1960s, there was a leadership conference on civil rights which included most of the unions, NAACP, most of the unions, the National Organization of Negro Women, et cetera, et cetera. Then there was SNCC and CORE, and they went and they did what Martin Luther King and the Montgomery movement did in 1955 in Montgomery. They simply disobeyed the law, the segregated laws, and they did it on the ground. The position of the leadership conference on direct action was to oppose it. How do I know? Because I was there. I mean, I was there. And they opposed it. And the fight between the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference on one side and the SNCC and the CORE was furious. They thought legal framework, government policy, was the only way to get change. And the people who were for direct action said, as individuals, if we don't take action directly and disrupt the segregated laws, we're going to be lost. And in fact, you know the story. The story was that the leadership conference type people who were dealing with legislation such as the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65 became in some ways the beneficiaries and the ambassadors of the direct action movement. My view is that if you have a blue-green alliance at the top, nothing wrong with that. But if you don't have direct action and fighting on the environment, for example, if you don't have, the AFL-CIO came out for Keystone.
They did.
You know that, right?
No.
Oh, you don't know that?
When did that happen?
Oh, Bob. They came out for Keystone about 3 months ago. Yes, and the United Steelworkers, which is part of the Blue-Green Alliance, is part of the AFL-CIO and did not raise a peep. Leo Girard is a wonderful guy. I know him. He's a sweet guy and all that stuff. And the steelworkers are much better than when I worked in the shop, on the one hand. On the other hand, they came out for Keystone. The way in which that situation is going to be resolved is if people start to inhabit the route to Keystone, if Obama approves it, which he probably will. He might not. I hope he doesn't. But if he probably will, then there's going to have to be mass action. And that's what the 1934 general strikes in Minneapolis and in San Francisco were all about. By the way, you forgot one strike, the National Textile Strike of 1934, which was led by Social Democrats. And it was betrayed, not by the Social Democrats, but by Roosevelt. You should know the story. And the point that obviously is so important, I think, is that we will have a blue-green alliance at the bottom, and then we're going to have action. And the unions are not capable of actually carrying the fight. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true, having been a union organizer for 7 years of my own life after I worked in the mill.
Okay. You've done everything.
I've done
that's
a lot
not
of things.
Fair.
Unfortunately, it isn't fair.
My name is Christoph, and like Jason, I'm a supporter of the IBT, so I'm a revolutionary socialist. And as such, I'd like to comment on the Swedish model, or the slightly improved Swedish model that one of the speakers presented. The Swedish model, which of course assumes that it would be nice to have a capitalism that is sort of nice to everybody, you know, the capitalists get what they want, and the workers get some more, and workers and capitalists go together in a sauna, and it's all lovey-dovey. But the problem with it is that it actually does not last very long in reality, because it only lasts as long as the capitalists get what they want. Once the capitalists don't get what they need during that arrangement, they simply break up the arrangement. And that's what actually happened. The Swedish model, which always comes back in every discussion, is actually dead. It died at the latest in 2008, 2009, when the economy started to go into recession. What do you think happened in Sweden? Did you think that capitalists stood by and watched their profits disappear? No, they did not. They broke up the social partnership agreement with the Swedish workers, and there was unemployment all of a sudden.
That's right.
And wages were cut.
That's right.
The Swedish model is dead, and there's a good reason for it. Because the fundamental contradictions that are sort of plastered over in the Swedish model do not go away. The workers and the bosses, the bourgeoisie, have fundamentally opposed interests, and they will always come to the surface, no matter how much social partnership tries to suppress those contradictions.
Thank you.
So that's one point I would like to make, because the illusion that capitalism can work is a strong one, and I think a dangerous one. Every generation can point to a time when capitalism seemed to work. Prior to 2008, most people probably thought, capitalism is not so bad. You know, it could be better, I could have higher wages. But that changed very quickly once the recession started. And I think that what we're starting with now is, of course, an extremely weak labor movement. And I think Jason and some others commented on the fact that the labor movement is in a terrible state, really. And some of the reasons have already been elaborated. So what remains to be done? What is necessary to be done now? I think that the organized labor movement needs to be rebuilt through conscious interventions of Marxists. Because currently, the labor movement is led by people who effectively sell out the workers whenever they can.
We'll wrap up the question. Just so we can get some.
Yeah, so in order to make life better for everybody, the trade unions need to be reorganized along political lines that turn them into combative organizations again, so that they can truly represent the interests of the workers and achieve things for the workers in struggle against the capitalists.
Thank you. Do you have another question before we return to the panelists? Yep, go ahead.
Sort of touches on that, but I wanted to ask you, we're talking about the problems with union bureaucracy, and I was wondering if what you think solutions might be, or if there have been any positive reformations in any unions that can move over.
Sure. Should I answer? Or?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. My conception of what the union should be is essentially a Red Army in embryo, is that it should be a fighting organization of the working class. What are the unions in the U.S. today? You know, in a lot of ways, it's like a special interest lobbying group to not have workplace rights eroded too much and try to get wage increases whenever possible. I work in New York State in the public sector. I've been in public sector unions for the last 15 years. Before that, I was in the Teamsters Union for a while. And the debate that happens around the labor movement that actually makes it into the newspapers tends to be a lot of really super exploited workers grumbling that trade unionists are paid too much off of taxpayer dollars. And they identify the union actually with the public sector because there is so little unionization in the private sector that they're aware of and that's visible. And then you get, you know, both Democratic and Republican politicians chiming in on this and supporting this idea and pushing through austerity budgets. Our sister union that's really been under attack has been the school teachers, with both charter schools undercutting teachers' unions and measures of testing being put through that is linked to teacher performance, supposedly. And what ends up by happening is that the bureaucracy, in a sense, by orienting so much towards putting together political action funds to vote individual Democrats into office, it has a very alienating effect on the rank and file union membership, too, where the participation in our union, even at a period when we're under attack, is very low. I think what needs to happen is to, you know, have a political intervention, as Christoph touched on, into the unions to fight for a program within the unions. It's a lot easier to point to the models that I don't think work than the models that I do think work.
What do you mean a program within the unions? To fight for a program within the unions?
Well, what we advocate is really forming caucuses in the unions that run people for office based on some sort of a program, and that the program be one that, for instance, explicitly say that we're willing to defy injunctions, or we're willing to defy laws against the public sector striking, which is, you know, the way things are set up right now in New York State. The other aspect that I think is important to look at are things like the Teamsters for a Democratic Union when they sued the unions. We don't think that that's a good model. We don't think that calling for state intervention, even when the union is very corrupt, is actually empowering to the unions. We think that labor has to clean its own house, that essentially it has to be a rank-and-file movement from within the union and from political allies of the union from outside, you know, not a matter of calling for an attorney general investigation into the finances of the union or something like that. You know, I think that the organization of unorganized workers is also something that, you know, would have an empowering movement, empowering impact on the labor movement.
Stanley? There is a sad history of rank-and-file movements in the labor movement in the United States. It's a very sad history. I could do this for you, but I'm going to do it with the best example, because to give you the bad examples is no good. The best example is Teamsters for a Democratic Union. And the reason it's the best example is because they took power in the Teamsters Union with in an alliance with some dissident presidents and leaders of who are not at all radical. When they took power, they staged the best strike that we've had essentially since the general strike of 1946, which is the United Parcel Strike, right? I mean, that was the best strike. But they got waylaid, and they lost leadership. Ron Carey and his people were disobeying the law to raise money to run a campaign against James P. Hoffa, who was still the president of the union. There are other examples that are not dissimilar of rank-and-file movements that take power in the union and are still constrained by the law. Now, I have to say this because it's not small potatoes. It's really the heart, in my view, of the matter of the problem with rank-and-file movements. The Taft-Hartley amendments, as well as the National Labor Relations Law, are anti-union laws because they constrain the workers from taking direct action in the shop floor, at the shop floor, and you can't strike except at certain points at the expiration of the contract. There hasn't been a single major challenge to the National Labor Relations Act and to the Taft-Hartley amendments in the American labor movement, including those who consider themselves on the left. KDU ran a campaign to win power in the Teamsters Union for what Jason correctly opposes: bread and butter. And they have a bread and butter politics rather than a politics of transformative politics. They don't have to agree of being a Red Army. I don't think that's necessary. But at the moment, you know. But the problem is that if you organize caucuses, and I'm entirely for organizing caucuses, to take power under these circumstances is self-defeating. It would be better to have an agitational caucus that continues to educate, win shop floor positions, yes, and fight for a set of demands, as Jason suggests. I have to say this so that you understand where I'm coming from. I'm a professor, but I was a member of the executive council of a rank-and-file caucus that took power in the Professional Staff Congress at the City University of New York. Not a big union, only 18,000 people that we represent. 18,000 people. We have become a bureaucratically addled union in the tail of the Democratic Party. It makes you want to throw up. No. But I stepped down after 9 years. I was a member of the negotiating committee. I was a member of the negotiating committee and did a lot of negotiating of the union contract. The union contract is a problem. The union, we'd be better off without contracts, which reminds me. Remember the IWW? Mm-hmm. The IWW didn't sign contracts. They went on strike, and they stopped the strike when they got their demands met. But they reserved their right to strike at any time, or to take a job action at any time. When you have a contract union, 24 years of my life was in the labor movement. I'm here to tell you that. You've got to hear this. When you have a contract union in the United States, I'm not talking about Sweden, there are certain constraints over which you have no control. And that problem speaks against taking power too precipitously, which doesn't mean eventually we wouldn't want to take power. It means under these circumstances, it'd be better to have a caucus that doesn't take power.
Bob, did you want to respond to this round of questions? Or?
Sure, I'll respond on your point on Sweden. I wasn't saying I was advocating Sweden as the end point, the end desirable point. And when I referred to slightly imaginary Sweden, what I was thinking about were these features of a social democratic model, such as national health care, such as abundant opportunities through public education, such as shorter work week, and such as a commitment to full employment. Sweden didn't exactly do all those things, but those were part of the agenda. Now, whether it's completely collapsed as of 2008, we can debate that, but I think you're anyway making my point, because if it lasted from 1930 to 2008, under capitalism, that's not a bad run. Nobody expects any set of institutions to operate forever under capitalism. My fundamental point is not Sweden, Sweden or different models, but for those of us on the left, I think that what we have to take really seriously is how you get from A to B. And this is not a trivial question. We can envision a zero work society or guaranteed income, and I'm for that. The guaranteed income, like I was doing, I mentioned I was doing work in South Africa on macro policy, and I supported the basic income grant idea there and got a huge amount of pushback from other people on the left as being unrealistic. Blah, blah, blah. So that's real, you know. These people that fought and defeated apartheid saying to me, yeah, that's great, basic income grant, but we can't do that one right now. So this is an example of the challenges of getting from here to there. And I don't know, these things are historically contingent. And when you try to get from here to there, and you can't get from here to there entirely, and you see the constraints under which you're operating, under the variant of capitalism in which you're operating, that's a politically educating experience as well. And you think about further transformative struggles. But to say that, you know, the Swedish model doesn't tell us anything and that we need a full defeat of capitalism, I don't think is recognizing the need to get from here to there. So my final point is, I agree, Red Army, yes. But the Red Army has to have immediate demands. The Red Army is not going to win just by saying, complete obliteration of capitalism. For one thing, I don't even know what that means. Because when we flip off the capitalist switch, what do we flip on? What does socialism really look like?
Thank you. We're running up against our time limit. I want to take one more round of questions. If I could just ask the questioners and panelists to be brief in their remarks. I have a question in the front and then a question in the back.
Yeah, briefly, you were talking about the dependency of workers, the wage relationship, as if you're out of work, you're going to starve. But another new constraint on that is the fact that when you're out of work, you cannot fulfill your debt payments. And how this explosion of household debt changes this dependency, and also for the demand about reducing the wage, the working week, while people are struggling to finding more jobs to be able to fulfill their debt payments. So I would like to just have a quick response on this. And the last thing was about the bureaucracies and the fact that people are dependent on union bureaucracies. I'm not that sure that workers are big lovers of their bureaucratic executives at that time, and I think that's truly profound, is that people are, it's about fatalism, that there's no alternative possible. And that's something Sam Gindin was reliving just in a workshop before, about the fact that it's not a big issue of just fighting people that are alienated through, you know, bureaucracies. It's just to bring up meaningful alternatives, and this is where I think the transitional program and the immediate demands make sense of be able to build on and to broaden the alternative prospect.
And you, sir?
Yeah, my question is for Robert Paul, and I was curious about your quoting your colleagues complain about cooperatives that they take too much time, because organizing a union takes a lot of time. Even just running a union takes a lot of time. And the difference with cooperatives is this is time included what you get compensated for, and all these others are taken out of your hide, so to speak. And the other difference is that a cooperative is non-alien, in the sense that you're working with people, not for someone else. So I wondered about what your qualms about cooperatives are in that light.
Okay.
Who'd like to begin?
I'll just answer the first question and leave Bob the second, although I am for cooperatives, and I think they're very important. I want to give you the example of Richmond, California. Elected a Green Party member as mayor.
That was you?
No. Don't be so funny. There's a lot of foreclosures in Richmond, California, because it's a working class town. They've had deindustrialization. I don't want to go through all of the things. What do you do about, what you want a reform? What do you do about foreclosures? The proposal that she has made, which the city council has passed, is that they use eminent domain to seize the houses that are in foreclosure and maintain the people who are living there, depriving the banks of taking over. The banks are going stark, raving mad. The pushback is obviously substantial. We don't know yet what the result will be of this struggle between a working class town with progressive trade unions participating on the side of the Green Party mayor, who's made this proposal, and the banks, and large businesses. Now, one of the things that's so interesting about this fight is that if they simply rely on the law, and that's where I'm going, then they could lose. They have just won a judge's decision that it is not illegal to apply eminent domain. But if there are some attempts after the law is upheld by a higher court to remove people from their houses, then the way in which you're going to deal with it, we would have to deal with that collectively, is that people would have to block the entryway so that people cannot be evicted. Now, you think this has never happened? It has happened. Now, it happened in the 1930s. It has happened in the 1960s. We had rent strikes in New York City. 40,000 units of housing were on rent strike at one time in the winter of 1964-65. I won't tell you my role in it, but I was involved. But the point that I'm making is it's the combination of a kind of a political imagination and direct action that really is a strategy that simply doesn't take the most, bureaucratic view of the law, but takes it in together with mass activity.
Well, I took as a premise that this whole discussion was sort of a here to there discussion. And, I certainly, don't think that caucuses are immediately going to take control of the unions and lead a general strike that's going to lead to revolution. It is an agitational perspective. We conceive of ourselves as a fighting propaganda group. We think that we need to disseminate agitational literature, but also participate in real struggles as they occur, including in the unions. And, you know, of course, you don't talk about doing caucuses if you're not serious about being willing to try to win through caucuses and do exemplary actions. You know, and when I say exemplary actions, I'm thinking of things like the one-day port shutdowns and that sort of thing as models that, you know, have a transformative effect on the people who participate in them in terms of the way that they think about emancipatory politics. I think the point about the state is a key point because, you know, one of the things that is a great insight of Marxism is that the state is not a neutral instrument. It is the instrument of oppression by which the ruling class maintains control. In a relatively wealthy nation, it can afford to do so with a great deal of democracy, as long as, you know, the profitability of the capitalists is maintained and, you know, if it makes things run smoother, some concessions are willing to be made. I mean, de Blasio will probably be the mayor, not Bloomberg, in, you know, a few months. And that's because, you know, the 1% that lives in New York City is willing to have a reform-minded mayor. If it just makes the general quality of life in the city a little better, they're not worried that Bill de Blasio is going to expropriate them. So that's okay. You know, the Democratic Party, it's time for a Democrat to come in. Like, we've had Giuliani, we've had Bloomberg, and now we'll try things a little bit differently for a while.
I think it's very astute, by the way.
I wanted to answer the thing about co-ops. You know, I was, you know, saw something, probably it's 10 years ago now, but there was a strike in a bicycle factory in France, or maybe it was a factory that was going out of business.
The Nape strike.
And the workers set up a co-op to actually. And those kinds of things, that's an impressive thing, and there is something about workers' control that is represented by something like that. But the reality is that as long as we're operating under capitalism, every co-op, from that example to, you know, the food co-op where I sometimes buy some of my groceries, is still subject to the market, it's still operating under private property, and the growth of co-ops alone isn't going to lead to socialism. And I believe that Rosa Luxemburg addressed this in Reform and Revolution, which is a great pamphlet that I read a long time ago, but I'm almost certain she nailed it there. And that too, yeah. So I don't think co-ops are the solution, although, you know, I realize that it's a much less alienating form of work for some workers who work within it, as long as the co-op is able to stay afloat under capitalism, which is perpetually going in and out of cycles of crisis. So.
Bob, would you like the last word?
Yeah, and then you don't have to put up the sign because I'll just keep talking until everybody leaves. Well, first of all, in terms of making claims about history, since I was teasing you, I wrote a monograph published in 1990 called Deeper in Debt, the Changing Financial Conditions of U.S. Households. So I've been interested in this problem of household debt for a long time. And in 1990, when I wrote this, I said that there were, you know, I was already seeing the pattern, but at the time, the prevailing view of this was that it was excessive consumption. You know, that, you know, people just wanted to more stuff. And what my research showed instead was there are really kind of bifurcated patterns. On the one hand, you had like the rich people were borrowing more to speculate on Wall Street. And then middle class actually wasn't borrowing more. It was stable. It was the lower 40% of the income distribution that was borrowing more to sustain their living standard in the face of stagnant wages. So, by the way, that one point you made before about wages always going up till 2008... wages haven't gone up since 1973. And so people were borrowing more to try and increasing hours to try to maintain their living standard, and that was the phenomenon. So the rise of household debt is very much integral to neoliberalism and the attack on the working class that neoliberalism represents. On co-ops, yes. Yeah, like I said, I'm just getting warmed up now. So, on co-ops, I'm not against co-ops. Don't get me wrong. That was not a principled opposition. What I'm saying is I'm not for each and every co-op. I think we have to judge them critically And there are problems with I'll tell you right now, I teach at this university, and there are people at my university who are strong proponents of co-ops. But then when it comes to meetings in which they're participating, they're completely uncooperative. And that's part of the problem. I think that that's what my wonderful colleague Nancy Fulbright exactly had in mind. You know, we can talk all we want and abstract about co-ops, but in the end, it's people getting together, and we have other constraints on our time. You know, maybe I would rather be off playing basketball than sitting in a meeting listening to somebody pontificate, which is probably you're tired of listening to me pontificate, so I'll end right there.
Let's give a round of applause to the panelists. Thank you very much. I just want to remind everyone there's more materials on Platypus available over there, and I think there will be some IBT materials as well. And the Politics of Work is an ongoing panel series.
The only thing people do is
I get down
as an engineer. Then people love meetings more than I mean, that's the point. That's free. That's not just getting
funded. I'm on the executive committee.
Being a part of the panel was
Ruben Moore and Strike
is kind of a pedagogical organization. We're really kind of trying to bring together the various strands of the dispersed, disintegrated left that's still
bring
them into conversation with each other.
Yeah, I'm in the trenches with them.
And you have each other basically that are interact in the world. So to see
we have a problem with academia because what we're doing is most jobs are
on the same problem that don't necessarily and became more interested in organizing events kind of like this. So they became more of a political organization, and it's spread since then. And yeah, so I just joined the organization recently, but I've been following it for a while. You know, we have a lot of high quality events just like this, thanks to cartoon participation. And, you know, it's been going pretty well so far. So.
Okay, well, it was fun. It was very useful. So, yeah, in touch.
Well, yeah, and thank you so much for being a part of that. I really do appreciate it. So.
Cool.
With your work on the green economy, have you put together any sort of like? Is there an amount that you think sort of like an amount and like a number of jobs that you? Yes,
yeah,
there
that's
is.
What I've been grinding that stuff out like mad. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in, it's never going to happen, but getting QE resources spent on things other than just treasury bonds and housing bonds.
Yeah.
And so collecting information on people that have done some of the groundwork on that. And I coincidentally just read
You're at CUNY?
Someone else came up with the term yesterday, extra institutional.
Oh, cool.
I just read Nancy Fulbright's book, The Invisible Heart, and I think that's another, there's so much research that could be done and so many jobs that could be created, you know, doing that research. Well, thanks for your talk.
Yeah.